Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, what the fuck happened in there? What the fuck happened out here?
The plan started. Think I'm part of it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding Westworld, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Westworld. I'm David Chen.
And I'm Joanna Robinson.
Welcome to the podcast. What we do here on Decoding Westworld every week is we spoil and discuss and theorize about this week's episode of Westworld. But we do not spoil anything from future week's episodes. That includes anything on the next time on preview for Westworld. This week we'll be discussing Season 3, Episode 5, entitled Genre. But before we get into any of that, we always like to get into follow-ups, things we thought of after we recorded the podcast that we forgot to get on there, and your emails, which you can keep coming into decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Now, Jonah Robinson, I have often had the theory that when somebody says something on a podcast and they get 1,000 corrections to it in email, it's actually a sign of a thriving podcast.
Oh, yeah? Know? Okay.
Because,
okay. Good to know.
Because if they don't respond, then there's one of two options. Either no one's listening, or they do listen, but they just don't think you have very high standards. So I actually think corrections are a good thing, which is why I'm so excited that we got approximately 500,000 emails this week about a comment you made on last week's episode of the podcast. You want to recap that for us, Joanna?
I did not go back and listen to the episode, but I believe what I said when Bernard is in the motel in Southern California and he sees rockets going off in the distance and rockets landing in the distance, I believe I said something like, rockets don't land like that now. What a cool vision of the future, right? Or do rockets land like that? I think I introduced an element of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. I don't
that,
think
that sounds about
I
right.
was
that sounds right, yep.
deeply certain. Anyway, as it turns out... Dave Chen. Rockets do land like that in the Elon Musk SpaceX program. Also, fun fact, Jonathan Nolan himself has like shot videos of, you know, cool looking videos of these rocket landings. I received many emails about this and a lot of tweets. Can I just say really quickly?
Yeah.
It is, you know, if I say something wrong, or especially if I say, do they? And you're like, I got to tell her they do. Oh, my God. That's fine. I will say, though, about like 75% of you started your emails and or tweets with like, I'm sure someone else has already told you this, but. And I just want to like ask you to look inwards at yourself and wonder what it is about yourself that causes you then to continue to write that email or tweet if you are sure someone else has already told me.
Well, I think the problem is that the brilliance of Elon Musk cannot be questioned, Joanna Robinson. You know, I mean, how dare any of us mere mortals repudiate any of his discoveries?
I will say a few of you were incredibly mean, and I don't know why. So much so that Dave asked me like on Monday if I wanted to edit the section out of the podcast to stop people from responding, and I said no, let it stand. So.
I was totally willing to go back against my journalistic integrity and excise the offending portion, because that's happened to me before on like a podcast, like the Slash Filmcast or something, where I'll make a mistake and then I say to myself, well, rather than get corrections on Twitter for the next 7 days, I'm just going to go back in and snip that bit out. But Joanna is hardier than me. You know, you're made of tougher stuff than David Chen.
Or maybe I just like then whining about it on Twitter and being the victim. Either way.
You choose to take on the slings and arrows of people's Elon Musk related corrections.
I learned a lesson, which is, here's the really important lesson. Uh-huh. Don't cross The Muskers.
Yes.
The Muskheads will have their day.
I believe they're called Elon Files. No, I'm just, no, I'm just joking.
So upsetting.
But thank you for the emails about that topic. The correction is understood. SpaceX is amazing. Long may they reign. Long may they reign. So say we all. Speaking of random things from last week's episode to follow up on, one of them is that, you know, it did occur to me after we talked about the scene where they do the bank heist with Aaron Paul's character, Caleb. Isn't it just so odd that they request like a blood sample, but when they pull the blood sample, they don't pull up like a photo ID of the person? You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, I would say even when Bernard himself jacks into his own iPad, a photo of him comes up. So where's the photo with the profile for this guy they took the blood out of? So
I get thrown off whenever anything futuristic doesn't match up to the security technology we have today. You know, like today we have Face ID on millions and millions of iPhones. They do not have that in Westworld Future World, which is a shame because it would have prevented trillions of dollars from getting stolen or however the hell, how much he took. Anyway, another follow-up to last week's episode. We talked about how Ramin Djawadi's orchestral arrangement of Wicked Games was pretty badass during that scene where they were auctioning off people. And I think Ramin Djawadi was actually listening to this podcast because within days of us talking about it, that song is now available on all streaming platforms. So thanks for me for
putting that out there.
We did that. I'm just joking. Ramin doesn't know who we are, but but it's nice to think about it. It's nice to think about it, isn't it? In these times, Joanna.
Yes, in these troubling times, yes.
On that note, here, let me just take us down a random path, which is, I don't know if you watch any, like in general, you and I rarely watch TV on broadcast television because a lot of the shows we watch are cable, or you'll get screeners, or I'll watch it on Netflix or whatever, or Prime Video. And I had a chance to watch Better Call Saul recently, and I have YouTube TV, so I basically watch a DVR'd version of Better Call Saul. And first of all, let me just say this week's episode of Better Call Saul is one of the best episodes of Better Call Saul I've ever seen, possibly one of the best episodes of television I've ever seen.
I've heard. Yeah.
It is absolutely incredible. And but I was watching it and I noticed that many of the TV commercials kind of obliquely acknowledge that we are living through a pandemic, but they never say what it is that's happening.
Same experience. I watched the Schitt's Creek finale live. And had commercials for the first time in like so long. And I was so weirded out by all the pandemic commercials. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's just because I understand why they're doing what they're doing, which is they don't want to give a name to the thing. They don't want to, because I presume that identifying and reminding people of the actual thing they're going through is a huge downer from a sales perspective. Like, people don't want to be reminded of the tough times they're going through, but it just creates this really kind of perverse, weird situation where every commercial is alluding to this extremely challenging event, but nobody is saying what it is.
Yeah.
It's like a real life version of Westworld where they're just hinting at things, but they're not revealing them.
The incident.
There's actually a great Mitchell and Webb look, sketch. It's about it's a game show that takes place after the event, and they keep referring to the event, which these commercials remind me of. Anyway, okay, Wicked Games now streaming. Ramin Djawadi's version. Check it out. Okay,
there was also a cover of a Bjork song that I missed that played when Ciroc and Maeve are talking in that restaurant in the Philippines. So a couple people wrote in to be like, what about you forgot about Bjork? So I never want to forget about Bjork. So my apologies.
Yes. The excellent Bjork song Hunter earlier in the episode. So,
so before we
get to the episode, Jenna Robinson, you have a couple of theories you want to discuss that have been floating up.
So we're in a fun position right now because this is the first time, well, I guess last week was the first time, but like I have not seen any future episodes. So if we do any like wild speculation on this podcast, it's just going to be like pure solid gold wild speculation. Like, how fun. Which means I finally jumped over to Reddit because like sometimes it stresses me out to see like theories I know are wrong. So I've been kind of avoiding Reddit this season because like it stresses me out to watch people like get themselves wound up about like, I don't know, say who's in Charlotte Hale's body when like I know what the right answer is, if that makes
I'm
sense.
I'm curious. Why does that stress you out? Let's dive a little bit into this.
Know that we need to psychoanalyze that. I don't know. There's just like, because people get so attached to their theories and they get really bummed out.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's what comes after. It's not the actual theorizing, it's what comes after when they're revealed to be incorrect.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That can be stressful. Theorizing is like so fun and like incorrect theorizing. I mean, I'm the queen of that, so let's do it. But there are two main theories sort of roaring through Reddit that I want to talk about. I don't agree with either of them, but I thought we should at least like talk about them, and I'd love to hear your theory on them.
All right.
Basically, the Redditors are, having been burned by timey-wimey bullshit in the first two seasons of Westworld, are like on a knife's edge, really worried that like Lisa Joy and Jonah are gonna like pull a rug out from under them on something, right? So they've concocted two
which we all know would be a worst case scenario if they did that, right?
They've concocted elaborate theories about like, so to try to like anticipate like haha fooled you moment, they could be like, no, I saw it coming anyway. So the first one is this idea of a mirror world. Okay, so Rehoboam, or the system at large, you know, we saw a lot more information about it this week, and basically would you say it runs simulations? Like it runs, it makes predictions based on, you know, what have you. So,
I'm going to get into this later, but the devs comparisons are really hot and heavy now, but we can dive into it later. But yes, roughly what you're saying is right.
So there have been some continuity errors throughout the season. Like a woman in the background might be folding one color blanket, then she's folding another. Or two people, there's like four of them that seem a little sloppy if they're just continuity errors. And not like crazy sloppy, just a little sloppy. And so people are like, would it? Well, the biggest one being, in the Charlotte Hale episode 3, we see her, you know, talk to the camera and say like, the real Charlotte say like, you know, this is for Nathan, you know, part of her message from the massacre on the park. Right. Mm-hmm. And we see a short version of it at the beginning of the episode. Then we see a longer version of it at the end of the episode. And the version we see at the beginning of the episode has basically been edited, versus the one at the end of the episode. I think that's just a storytelling device. Like they were just showing some of us at the beginning and the full thing at the end, especially since we weren't supposed to know who Nathan was yet and stuff like that. But it has spooked enough people that they have decided that there is something going on. It's called a mirror world, where sometimes when we think we're watching the real world, actually we're watching what Rehoboam thinks is going to happen versus what is actually happening. So they're running a mirror world to our own world inside the system. I think the main reason I don't believe in both of these theories is I think they will be the kind of tricksy that the Nolans have promised they're not going to do this season. Mm-hmm. So I think if that were the case, if we were going to have to go back through the season with a fine tooth comb to figure out when we were in a mirror world and when we weren't, like that really betrays the promise that they made to make a more straightforward show. So I don't think it's a mirror world. Do you have any thoughts of that, about that?
I would agree that we're probably not seeing a mirror world, although I will say the thing, I don't think that's true, but the thing that, I don't think the mirror world theory is true, but the thing that kind of makes me think twice about it is what's been odd is there's been numerous occasions in the show where the AR glasses are placed on someone's face and mm-hmm. we don't see what they see. And I just think, huh, that's really weird, because like in the first episode when that happened, they showed us what that person saw. And then subsequent times, like this episode, you don't see what that person sees.
And right, so I'm just but like, there's a reason for that in this week's episode.
Well, that's fair enough. But I'm just saying, you know, I'm like, huh, I wonder if maybe there's something that they're seeing that, you know, that, well, okay, never mind. I don't think it's true. Next theory.
The next theory is the ongoing simulation theory that that we have yet to see Maeve in the real world and that she is still in a simulation.
Mm.
And once again, both of these theories are incredibly popular, at least, you know, in the Reddit dive that I did. And I just think that that's not true. Doesn't make sense, especially the way that like the Yakuza plot bled into the, you know, Ciroc on his plane plot, which bled into, you know, it was all connected. I don't think that that's true.
Well, here's the thing that in all of our podcasting adventures, I have tried to encourage our listeners to contemplate, which is, if the theory is true, how does it make the show richer? Like, does it make the show more interesting or richer if the theory is true? Versus just, hey, I think Sansa's pregnant. You know, like, it just, why is the show better off if that theory is true? And I will say, in the theory's defense, is like, you know, these actually aren't, like, when you say these theories, I'm not like, oh, that's completely out of the character for the show. You know, like, it is possible that Maeve is in a simulation in a simulation.
You know, my favorite theory that, that we didn't talk about, but didn't happen, but it was really fun, is when people were trying to guess who was in Charlotte Hale's body.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you heard this, Charlotte is Dolores's horse theory. My favorite one.
It's amazing.
It's her horse from Westworld. But what's fun is that Dolores has a moment in this episode where she definitely treats that motorbike like it's her horse.
Right.
And I was just like, oh, there's her horse, guys. Don't worry, it's still here. But yeah. Anyway.
So would the show be better or more interesting if Maeve was still in a simulation? I get that doesn't really strike me as thematically interesting. It's maybe a pull the rug, you know, out from under you thing, but.
And that's why I think last season sometimes feels like such a failure to me, because I'm not sure that whole like Charlotte was actually Dolores the whole time thing feels like a satisfying twist in that regard. Versus I do think the season one timeline split is satisfying because watching William turn into the Man in Black, I think that's a really interesting thing that they're showing us there. But season two, I'm not sure I got anything the same level of emotional interest to me. And then similarly here with the mirror world theory and the Maeve is still in a simulation theory, it's like that's just feels like a gotcha rather than a, you know, oh, so that means
right.
X,
right.
You know?
You know, this actually reminds me of this piece that Brandon Katz wrote this week. I was reading Brandon Katz write about Westworld over at The Observer, at observer.com. And I'll just read this one paragraph to you. He writes, quote, "Imagine the making of a television show as the construction of a house. The main characters and central themes are the sturdy foundation that support continued development. The main storylines are the walls that give structure and definition to the interior. Now throw in a series of trap doors and secret passageways that double for deliberately confusing and misdirecting mysteries. That might be cool in a fanciful sort of way, but possess a very limited utility. You don't want to throw a dinner party only for your guests to end up stuck inside a wall. And yet, following the fourth episode of Westworld this season, it's hard not to feel as if the audience is trapped in a carnival funhouse," end quote. Now, I'm not quite as negative as him on this. You know, I'm pretty close, but I'm not quite as negative. But I think the idea of if you think of a TV series as a house metaphor, right, and like surprises are like the back door, like the secret passageways, that's a great analogy, in my opinion, because the secret passageways are not where you want to live in the house. You know, like if you had guests in the house, you'd show them the secret passageway. You'd be like, hey, look at the secret passageway. And they'd say, oh, that's pretty cool. But then that's not where you'd spend most of your time. You know, you'd spend it in the dining room or in the study or in the lounge or in the speakeasy. This is a very lovely house, by the way, that I'm imagining. And I think that what we're seeing with episodes four, definitely episode four, to a lesser extent this episode, is that Westworld is still very much obsessed is maybe too strong of a word, but certainly very fixated on the idea of twists and turns, and it almost has become the point of the show rather than a nice to have that supplements the storytelling.
Right. We talked about this, not to keep beating a dead Dolores horse, but like the Charlotte reveal, it doesn't feel emotionally satisfying for me to know that, a week previous I had been watching Dolores go through a thing.
Right.
So that's the question.
Yeah.
But yeah, so those are some of the theories. There's another theory that Ciroc isn't like real, that he's just a hologram and or a sort of physical embodiment of the system itself. I think this episode disproves that, but you can, cling to that theory if you want. And I think that's all I've got.
All right. All right. So let's get to this week's episode, which is called Genre. Genre is the name of the drug that they ingested in last week's episode, and also that Caleb, I guess, gets injected into him in this episode.
Yeah.
And overall thoughts on this week's episode, John Robinson, before we dive into the recap.
Yeah. I was going over this episode and realizing that there is actually more of it I liked than I initially thought. Mm-hmm. And so it's just the titular conceit that doesn't work for me, but the Ciroc stuff really does work for me very well. To quote Bernard, I'm of two minds on this one, I think.
What is the titular conceit in your opinion? Just so I understand, just so we try to eschew obfuscation here.
Sorry, should I not have said the titular conceit? Caleb gets dosed with this drug. And so for the sort of like heisty action kidnapping section of the episode, he's tripping through five different genres of film that are given a different music cue to let you know what genre of film you're in. And I guess, my broad take on that is that I don't mind that idea. I think it's kind of cool. I think they just like gave it about 10% and they should have given it.
The execution.
Yeah.
Yeah. So overall, I thought pretty rough episode, in my opinion. I think you're right. Here's the thing I realized. In general, when Westworld is doing the flashbacks, it's really good. I would say overall, whenever Ciroc Westworld has flashbacks, they're pretty excellent in general.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can count like Jimmy Simpson's whole arc as a flashback. I wouldn't necessarily, but I mean, like, think about like Akichita in season two and all the stuff with like older Delos in season two. You know, like any time there's a flashback, I in general find it quite compelling. And all the Ciroc stuff was really well done. And very economical too, like really great storytelling, because they try to convey all this backstory and get it across in not that many scenes. So really love all the Ciroc stuff, and everything else not as much of a fan. And we'll get into why in a little bit, but yeah, that's kind of my overall thoughts. And the genre stuff that you mentioned, it really did not work for me at all, unfortunately. So those are my overall thoughts, but let's dive into the episode and get into specific thoughts. So there is four plot lines in this episode, and one of them is the Ciroc brothers, right? Mm-hmm. We get a dose of their history. We see that Jean-Michel and Enguerrand Ciroc survive the bombing of Paris, but they're put in quarantine because of nuclear exposure. Jean-Michel, the older one, is a genius, and together they create the system, but they need money and data. So they bring Liam Dempsey Sr. on board, but he is the worst. He gave them a yottabyte worth of data. So what's a yottabyte of data, Joanna Robinson?
So do you ever watch Westworld and you're like, is this a made-up word or is this a real word? Do rockets really land like this or not? So anyway, I Googled what a yottabyte was, and it is a large amount. It is 1 septillion bytes. Is a yottabyte of data. So if you think about a terabyte, but like much, 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 much more.
A terabyte, but much, much bigger. Thank you.
That's yeah, yeah. Wait. I have more information. One of the best ways to visualize this data was developed by Wikibon. Imagine a standard iPad with 16 gigabytes of storage is fully loaded. A single petabyte would equal about 62,500 of those. Now stack those iPads on top of each other and compare them to some of the world's tallest buildings. The Empire State Building is at 1,250 feet. Those iPads stacked up twice that height at 2,604 feet, almost as tall as the Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest building. The estimated amount of data in the digital world in 2010 was 1.2 ZB. I don't remember what that is. Or 75 billion fully loaded iPads.
75 billion iPads. Yeah. You know what I love? I love when the way people illustrate things is like, okay, I'm trying to convey to you how big this thing is, but then the thing that they use to do that is equally incomprehensible. You know, like,
yeah, that did wind up being gibberish. I thought it would be helpful. I'm not sure it was.
It's like, okay, you can't imagine a septillion bytes, but imagine 76 billion iPads. Okay, I guess I can kind of wrap my head around that. Anyway, it's a lot of data. It's a lot of data, right?
It's a lot of data.
At first, Liam Dempsey Sr. is pretty unhappy with what the Sirach brothers are doing. And he, by the way, lists lists the fact that they've done half a dozen versions. Now, this is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
He lists them as, he says, Saul, David, and Solomon, right? Now, those were kings of Israel in the Old Testament.
Correct.
And if you went to Sunday school, as I did, my understanding, and you know, this is me throwing my Twitter line on the line, my Twitter life mentions on the line here, but from what I learned at my extremely conservative Christian upbringing is that essentially the kings of Israel were these kind of like. Essentially, it was like Israel wanting to be ruled by a king, but like a king could never be as perfect as God. And so all these kings were really quite fallible in some way. They were all like really great in their own ways, but they all had pretty significant human flaws. And so the idea that it would be like Saul, David, Solomon, Rehoboam, like that you're going through these things, but like, and you hope each one is going to be the solution to your problems, like the thing that finally solves it, but in fact they're all like hideously flawed in some way. That had resonance with me. I don't know if I'm reading it correctly, based on my very elementary knowledge of this, but yeah.
Well, I love that. I love that idea. Like these are foul. Like this system that's trying to rule people is named after these very fallible kings who failed to rule their people in one way or another. With the authority that is godlike but is not God, and so perhaps, you know, Dolores is actually the true God. You know, that we should be talking about here.
It's interesting to me that for the one that is in season three, they chose Rehoboam, probably the least known one of all of these guys. You know what I mean?
Maybe they're hoping to hit us with that Kings of Israel that jazz a little later.
That offhanded reference, you mean? That maybe not even everyone got. But yeah, I mean, it's just like, why not choose...
I got that they were kings of Israel, but I did not go to Sunday school at all. So I'm really appreciative of your interpretation of that.
I'll just say, you know, who knows how much of my Sunday school is actually propaganda versus, you know, historical truth. So like, take it with a massive grain of rock salt. But you know, I'm just like, dude, Solomon is right there. Everyone knows who Solomon is. You know what I mean? Like, Solomon's like a well-known cultural figure, in my opinion. So
yeah.
But they went with Rehoboam, which bold move, Westworld writers, bold move.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Okay. So anyway, they continue putting together this system, and then they are able to use it to predict the stock market. But then and Liam Dempsey at first is really excited because he's making a lot of money, getting a lot of prestige. But eventually he kind of grows too big for his britches, and they have to take him out. Side note to this is that Ciroc starts imprisoning and experimenting on undesirables. And he says, quote, there are little white spaces, a bubble of agency. So people who essentially cannot be controlled by the system. Is that right? Like, once you tell them what they should do, they refuse to comply. Is that your understanding of this?
Yeah, but so like the people, we'll get to this a little bit more later, because it relates to Caleb and to William, I think. But, I'm a little worried it means people who are mentally unwell. Mm-hmm. But certainly, so his brother is one. These like flies in the ointment, these uncontrollable, unpredictable elements in the system. And I believe that when Ciroc is talking to Liam Dempsey Sr., he says, usually the way the system handles them is that it like sends them to a war zone or something, manipulates them into a situation where they will be disposed of, so that they can't continue to like trouble the system. Ciroc is like, what if instead we pluck them out of play and contain them and try to, I think the word that Liam Dempsey Sr. uses is like geld them.
You can't change our fate. You can't geld humankind. Somewhere in this group is an agitator who will destroy the world. I can't let that happen.
Hey, you've gone too far. No, I can't be a party to this.
Basically, like, do experiments on them to correct them, edit them, I think, is something Ciroc says. And so this idea of sort of, like, neutering them, changing them, enhancing them in some way so that they won't disturb the system, but they have a chance of survival. And to put a personal face on it, it's like his brother is one of those people, so, like, he has a motivation to figure out how to kind of save them. I mean, this is the whole thing with Ciroc that's so compelling and fascinating is like, he's not, is he deeply flawed in his ideas of controlling humanity? Yes. But does it come from this place of wanting to save the world? I kind of believe it does, So is he like being a monster about it? I mean, for sure. We watch him viciously murder a person, but, he's not doing it to amass power, at least not overtly. He at least has like drunk his own Kool-Aid, right? About why he's doing things.
Well, and they give him a pretty good backstory, which is that he's witnessed the horrors that mankind can inflict on itself, like he's witnessed the bombing of Paris. I thought all this was really interesting, and the way the story was really well told. My one beef with this is just the process of the system kind of taking control of society. I just feel like there's a little bit of material missing there. I don't know if you feel that way, but I compare this to a show like Devs, which I know people might be tired of me talking about, but the it's so similar. In fact, they even use the same metaphor. In Devs, there's this a thing called, they call it tram lines. Like, we're on tram lines. And I think in this episode, they call it like, we're off the train tracks now or something. We're off the rails now or something like that.
And no, they've been on a train. We're showing them the rails.
Yeah, they've been on the train. Yeah, so it's like rails versus like tram lines. It just feels like, and they're dealing with very similar topics. But like Devs takes place over the course of maybe 2 weeks or whatever. It's a very short period of time. Whereas in this show, you're jumping forward years. In the matter of seconds, and I just feel like it might have fast-forwarded just a touch too much for me in terms of how they went from, hey, these two brothers building the system to, oh, by the way, the system now runs all of society. But that's me. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I thought you were going to have similar questions about when we see Ciroc talking to the Brazilian president I thought you were going to have classic Chen-esque questions about how this all works exactly.
No, that part I actually, that's the thing, is like, if you can convince me that he has taken control of society using Rehoboam, then the Brazilian president, that all makes sense. You know, like that's very logical to me. So it's just like that process that I felt was a little bit lacking in this episode. But
well, I think and it's not fair to judge the show based on like external material they've released, but they have released info, like backstory info about how like governmental, because basically Insight Technology runs everything, right? Basically, find out that Insight Technology runs everything. You know, Dolores says some exposition about that. Like, it even runs this, you know, this driverless car or whatever. So, I don't know. I think there's ways in which, like, the creep of technology, I could see it happening, like, 30 years in our future. Yes, I could see a system that sort of, like, we all sign up for. Because of the, you know, but anyway, they released some additional info about data laws and the government and what Insight was able to gather data wise of why Insight has a yodabyte of data on us, et cetera. So, I don't know. I kind of believe that. Whereas, you know, if we want to hop on over to, Serac in the present
closer,
talent.
Closer to present day, right? Yeah. It's not present day, but yeah, closer to present day.
We see him in Brazil, talk to the Brazilian president, you know, snuffing out an insurrection, and basically saying that the Brazilian president needs to stop being so corrupt. And if he stops doing that, then this like potential insurrection will never happen. And he sort of, and the president's like, well, what if I don't do what you say? And he's like, well, then your currency will suddenly inexplicably be valueless and we're going to put that guy in charge, sort of thing. It reminded me very much of like things you hear about the CIA, you know, king making, king breaking around the world. My question is like, how does one man, Enguerrand Serac, even with his holograms and his like, you know, airship that he might live on, how does he manage to like hop? Is he Santa Claus? Like, how does he hop around the world fast enough to be able to like snuff out all the potential disasters that are looming, you know?
He's like a modern day computer powered Superman, basically, right? Trying to stop global catastrophes before they happen. But I, you know, he's got this super cool jet, Joanna Robinson. So maybe it's a jet thing. Maybe that jet can go faster than we can even conceive. So
I'm just saying, if Serac were a better manager, he would have more people working for him than he trusts.
He's got to delegate.
Yes, he really does.
Yeah. I mean, he's got to delegate to people who don't get blown up real easy. How about that?
Yeah, R.I.P. His right hand woman, I guess.
Yeah, it's really starting to get attached to that character. So anyway,
one thing that I do want to mention about that, two things I want to mention about that Brazilian exchange is, he's looking at when he's sort of showing the data on the tablet about like the insurrection, things are marked on the map as sectors. And that's a very like Delos Park thing, right? Mm. Like it reminds me of season one when like the people at the Mesa in the park would be like, well, there's an, you know, oh, there's an issue over here in sector, you know, 20, we got to go check it out sort of thing. So just further underlining the connection between.
You're working on your Delos Westworld Park interview packet, it sounds like.
I think I have it nailed. Yeah. And then the fly motif, which I think is interesting, like he calls these uncontrollable elements in the system flies in the ointment, which I think is like a great thing to say. But also there's this like fly that's sort of buzzing around the Brazilian president as he's talking, and he keeps swatting away at it, you know, and when someone swats at a fly in Westworld, like you're brought back to season one and like the flies and I Wouldn't Hurt a Fly and Dolores sort of like swatting at a fly and stuff like that, like all of that fly motif that we've seen. But I just thought it was interesting. Like it feels like it's meant to be like, you know, this is a disturbance in the system, you know, this Brazilian president that he has to like handle. I don't know if you have any other ideas as to why, that would have been there. But that was my take.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in general, when you see a fly on a TV show or a film, it's usually very deliberate, right? I mean,
he swats at it like broadly like five times. Like it's very much supposed
it's like
to be
seeing
there.
It's like seeing someone cough in a TV show or film. Generally, right. If they're coughing, it's kind of like they definitely put that in there on purpose, because otherwise they would have used another take. So yeah, I think that's all on the mark. So closer to modern day, Serac has other adventures. We see him with a wristwatch with a Rehoboam inkblot. I think the idea here being that this watch, or Rehoboam watch, as I believe it's called, allows him to see what Rehoboam is thinking and doing. It's kind of like a way to monitor it. Is that kind of
the implication later, when like sort of the black edge starts to thicken on the left side of it, like almost looking like an eclipse sort of thing happening in the watch, and he's angry about it. So to me, it's like, if we see a relatively healthy, water glass stain image on the watch, all is well. But if the black starts to bleed into the watch face, that means there's a problem in the system, unrest sort of thing. Yeah.
So anything else we want to talk about with regards to Serac's doings for the rest of this episode? I mean, he tries to stop Dolores and is not super successful, basically, right? And that involves the blowing up of his right-hand person by one of Dolores's agents. Anything else notable about this that you want to mention?
I mean, RIP Robot Connells. I think it's worth noting that he finds out that Dolores has agents in Jakarta, Berlin, San Francisco, and LA, right? LA is Connell, San Francisco is Charlotte, Jakarta, we presume, is Musashi. So Berlin is the question mark, the mystery host that's out there. That I'm still hoping is Clementine, but someone's in Berlin and we don't know who yet. So,
all right.
And then he also says I don't know. I got questions about, okay. Here's a quick question.
Uh-huh.
So when Maeve tries to rescue her own, like, CPU unit, right? Or is that redundant? CPU from the,
yeah,
from the Serac compound. Yeah. There are many more there, right? She's not
yes,
the only
correct.
CPU there,
yes.
Right? So there's something about the way that Serac says activate all assets. Now, he might just mean like alert every human that we have working for us around the globe. It's like the end of John Wick 2 or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, send all bounty hunters after these targets and let's go. But activate assets sounded almost like does he have, you know, he has a way to make a Maeve body. Does he have any other hosts working for him? I mean, I you know, we'll get to the one that I really think is working for him, but like, are there more? ?
I didn't get that, just because I don't know if you've seen the Bourne movies, like Jason Bourne, but like in all those movies, the assassins are referred to as assets.
Sure,
so that's kind of
sure.
just what I assumed.
Okay.
I assumed that Serac was a huge Bourne fan when he watched those.
I think I heard he has a tattoo that says Treadstone.
I think he's more of a Blackbriar kind of guy. Anyway, okay, we're done. Okay, so that's what happened with Serac this week. Before I move on, we got to thank all the people who donated to our Kickstarter. It's because of you that we're doing this podcast. Joanna Robinson, you want to thank some people?
Yes, I really do. I want to thank Josh Griffey, Sarah Trainer, Zach, Allison Rand, Alicia Janeway, Chris Osowski, Tapio Leopold, Joe Dossi, Mark Haycock, Billy Bosky, Eva Sun, The Man in Dingy Gray. Oh, the saddest. No, I can't. Sorry. Todd Muldrew, Sarah Tully, Andrew Korchinski, Swear Sigfusson, Tom Andreo, Dylan Neal, and the Von Barks. Not my best.
It was a solid performance. You know what's really interesting, Jenna Robinson is like, I would say that, you know, I work in an, I used to work in an office before the pandemic, and I would say that about 99% of the people who I work with, I have no problem pronouncing their names, but I would say a lot of the people here who donate to our stuff, they're from all around the world. And I'm like, sometimes I struggle, Joanna Robinson, sometimes I struggle. so it's only when we do these names that it reveals how ignorant of name pronunciations I truly am.
I get, like, I'm both really appreciative of the pronunciation guides, which we solicit, that we get. They're very helpful. But also they stress me out because, like, I'm trying. Anyway, whatever. Dave, who else do we want to thank?
Okay. David Nicholson from Aberdeen, Scotland. Tony Rollins, Heather Todd, Drew Gergich, Vijay Varman, Robert Cordero, Emily Ralph, Jim Fryer, Lauren Brown, Ben Anderson, Joe Keller, Reese and Almeida, Jessica Dobrovich, Matt Hall, Stacy Winkelpeck, Ken DiOrio, Fonda Chu, and Catherine Altmaier. Thank you so much for your contributions. It's because of people like you that we are doing Decoding Westworld this season. So thank you for your contributions.
Thank you so much.
Can I, you know, there's something I wanted to mention earlier in the episode that I didn't get to. Can I go on a digression?
Oh, I love a digression.
Which is, before we get back into this, which is that you said, hey, I'm a fan of the titular conceit. And I don't know if you know this, but Alan Schurstel, he used to write for Village Voice, very talented film critic. He has this vendetta against the word titular. Are you familiar with any of this?
No.
He hates the word titular because, in his opinion, 99% of the time that titular is used, it's used unnecessarily. You know, so you'll say something like, the people who will write a movie review say like, and so-and-so interacts with the titular Avengers. And it's like, well, you didn't really need to say titular. Like, if you just said Avengers, people would know which ones they are. But I will say that when you said titular conceit, I do think that that was a good usage of it. So I think that was a necessary usage. So
can I do a further digression?
Please. Please.
I got like really stressed out when you started that because when I was, are you familiar with the word eponymous?
Eponymous, yes, I am.
So eponymous, as far as I think, I hope I understand it, means titular, but it's like a it has to be a person.
Yes.
Right. So I misused eponymous in an essay in college once about Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse. And I said the eponymous lighthouse, right? When it should have been the titular lighthouse. Mm. And I mean, I can't, that's a really, you know, and my professor sort of called me out for it. And that's a really good calling me out because like, I was just trying to be unnecessarily fancy. And like, why? And I was incorrect. So anyway, he wrote me a poem in the margin of my essay. I hope I haven't told this story before. Anyway, maybe I have.
Do you have the poem?
I have it. I'm pretty sure I have it memorized because it was so shame making. He was a little loose and free and loose with the rhyme scheme. But it was like, there once was a girl named Joannimus who misused the word eponymous. Her logic so specious, the mistake so egregious, she wished she'd remained anonymous.
That is delightful. That is freaking delightful.
I might have missed like one word or two there, but that's basically it. So anyway, if you ever want to like make sure your student knows that they fucked up a word, please write them a poem in the margin. Right, yeah. Hey, next time I mess up something about Elon Musk, please send me your correction in the form
of a
poem.
In a limerick form, yeah. But to go back to my original point, which is extremely important.
Sure.
Very often the word titular, let me just say, I love the word titular. I used to use it all the time. But now every time I use it, I always question myself, Joanna Robinson.
Do I need this?
Yeah,
like,
do you need it? Would this sentence function without the word titular?
Honestly, you spend a lot of your life like trying to like fancify your language up as much as possible. And then you get to a certain point as a writer, I find that then you realize, that kind of writing is really obnoxious to read. And you then go through and start to try to like I love precise language. I'm not anti-precise language, but when I edit other people's work, sometimes I'm like, you fix the fancy word and you just use the like normal word because you're like, you don't need.
It's just, yeah, it's interesting when when I'm in like high school or college or something, it's like I want to put as many big fancy words in there as I can, and then like as I've gotten older, it's the complete opposite. It is it is you look at what you've written and you think to yourself, what words can I take out to make this as simple and understandable as possible? So that's kind of our arc in terms of writing, but you know, everyone needs to go on their own journey. You know,
the best use of titular is obviously the Ladybird line. It's a titular role. but other than that, yeah, use titular sparingly, folks.
Sparingly, and only when necessary.
Don't use misuse eponymous. All right, where are we at?
All right, so let's see. Bernard and Caitlin, let's do the Dolores stuff first. Can we do that first? Because I think, well, actually, no, you're right, because we ended with the Dolores and Caitlin stuff, right?
So
let's do the Bernard and Connell stuff first. So Bernard and Connell's, Bernard is with Connell's when he releases all the insight data, and Bernard tries to tell Connell's that living inside someone changes you, which is kind of what, I guess.
The Charlotte sort of thing.
The whole Dolores, like
Well, a big question we had, I think, with the all Dolores reveal is like, will there be upcoming conflict between Dolores Prime and the other Dolori, right?
Yeah.
And like, what this is a good example of.
I believe it's called a murder of Dolores. No, I'm just
Dolores is good. Was the Connell's version of Dolores is a very dutiful soldier Dolores, right? He's like just completely ready to die for the cause. We all have a role to play.
Right.
This is my role sort of thing. But is that like paving the way for one of the other Dolores, probably the Charlotte one, to not be so willing to, you know, die for the cause?
Yeah, there was a poignant moment when Dolores slash Connell, or Deronald as I like to call, or Delonel as I like to call her, him.
Do you?
No. is says to Bernard, you know, you need to go. You're the only one that can't be replaced, which I thought was interesting. It kind of acknowledging that there's multiple of her, so in a way, she's kind of expendable.
Well, and Bernard is very important for some reason, and I have a theory, but like that's, you know.
Do you want to share that, or do you want to?
Well, yeah. So like Connell's Dolores, his job is to release the data, protect Bernard, and then, you know, blow some of inside up, I guess. Or blow himself up so he can't be like taken apart or whatever, right? It's like the equivalent of like cracking the cyanide pill. So like, why is Bernard so important? And like Bernard then later says, when he and Stubbs walk out and they see like the world on fire, Bernard is like, this is her plan and I think I'm part of it. And so, you know, there's something about Bernard, who this whole season we've been getting those Arnold flashes to remind us that Bernard is not just Bernard, he's Bernard and Arnold. His pearl is gray and red, it's not just gray. So he's this hybrid, he's a human host hybrid. And I think he's going to be maybe a human host hybrid is the only thing that can get inside the Rehoboam system, because like, she released the data, but we know that Serac, like Liam Dempsey Jr., does not have the same kind of access to the system that Serac has. And like Dolores found that out in episode one, that she'd been kind of barking at the wrong tree with him a little bit. And so there's still something else she wants to do with the system. And, you know, like my instinct is that Dolores wants to go inside the system somehow, and that maybe Bernard, given his unique hybrid nature, is the only thing that can do that. One thing I did see floating around on Reddit that I liked is this visual connection between the gray and red of the Rehoboam system and the gray and red of Bernard's pearl, that it's like, you know, they are similar-ish, or at least, you know, sort of color connected in a way. So maybe hinting that that will be a connection going forward. But you know, he seems to be an important pawn. So this is where, forgive me monologuing, but this is where my Stubbs theory comes back into play, because I think you recall that when we found out that there was that Serac had another mole high up in the park who got Maeve out for him and who knows what else. And we were like, who could it be? I still very much think it's Stubbs. Bernard thinks Stubbs is working for him, but I think Stubbs is working for Serac. And my evidence this week for that is you will recall that like they're inside the Insight building, which is hard to get into, like so hard that Dolores had to like take over the body of Connell's in order to get in there. And Stubbs just shows up in the middle of it all. Like there's Serac men surrounding them from all sides. And then Stubbs just like pops out of a doorway. Is like, forget about me, motherfucker. You know? And like, that's just, it, to me, it
good,
seems like
good Stubbs impression, but yeah,
thank you. You know, so to me, it just seems like he's a Serac agent. And now, and if that's true, which I'm sticking by it until I'm proven otherwise, then Serac has Bernard, right?
I think that's a strong theory. Mm-hmm. Although the biggest piece of evidence against that theory is that security on this world, this whole future world, seems to be very bad overall. And so that would explain how Stubbs got in there. But, you know.
Fair. Fair. But like,
in the park, you know, in the...
you'll notice
the freaking simulation where they're keeping Maeve, you know, like
Stubbs asks a lot of questions. Mm. And if like I would, you know, if someone thinks this theory has some merit, then I would suggest you go back and watch the Stubbs scenes with that theory in mind and pay attention to all the questions that he asks Bernard.
Who do you think he was working for when he was slamming those four locos in a couple episodes ago?
Himself, baby, himself. Self-employed man.
So anyway, Bernard says...
Oh, wait.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, Bernard says he's part of Dolores' plan, and then they kind of flee, right? Bernard and Stubbs flee the building.
Oh, they see the chaos outside. Okay, but there's a big thing in the Bernard plotline this week. Connells takes the tablet and is like, before I go blow myself up, I need you to know something. These are re-education centers that Serac is using, basically like those the place where we saw where Serac's brother was.
Yeah.
And he pulls it up on the tablet. It says re-education center, and then we see a photo of the Inner Journeys Mental Health Institute, where William currently is. So William is in one of Serac's re-education centers. Mm. And I kind of assume that like Dolores has basically finagled, like William is basically her, you know, unwitting mole inside of a thing that she wants to get inside. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you think we're going to see William again this season?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
1,000%. Okay. Yeah. Right.
We should also mention, by the way, that I think Serac's plotline this week concluded with him murdering Dempsey, right? Or the flashback at least concluded with him murdering Dempsey.
It's a rough week for House Dempsey. both senior and junior do not make it out of the episode alive. Yeah, Liam said something in the first episode. He implied that Serac had killed his father.
Yeah.
And so that we see that that's true. And the irony of that, of course, is like it was Jean-Michel who was first like, we should kill Liam Dempsey Sr. And Serac kind of acts like, oh mon Dieu, we will not be killing people. But but yeah, he not only kills him, he kills him like amidst a, you know, makes it look like his jet crashed,
which I just thought was really weird. Like, why if you can make his jet crash, why wouldn't you just make him his jet crash with him in it?
I think we needed to see him.
Yeah, I get it from a character perspective. I've just never seen that before. Like, I've seen people like hijack people's jets and crash them or whatever on in a fictional piece of work, but I've never seen someone drive someone out to a jet crash and then bang his head into like a wing and be like, okay, he died in the crash.
It doesn't feel like CSI should be able to crack that case.
The black box is no evidence that Liam Dempsey was on that flight. Anyway, okay, let's talk about Dolores Caleb and Liam Dempsey Jr. So what happens with Caleb this week? He and Liam Dempsey are arguing. They need some piece of information from Liam, right?
Not enough to get his hash key, which they got 2 weeks ago. Now they need his private key.
Yeah.
In order to get into the system.
It's multiple MacGuffins. I mean, keys that they need to get. And so they're able to get it. And then, like, he says, well, it's... And by the way, anytime someone in a piece of fiction says, well, that's never going to be of any use to you, you need to do blank in order to use it, you know that they're going to figure out a way to use it. And in this case of Dolores, she's able to use it because... she is.
You'd have to be in two places at
you'd
once.
You'd have to be in two places at once, which is conveniently the one thing we learned you can do last week. So
Dolores can be in up to four places at once. Well, now
maybe
three,
five.
I suppose
maybe five. So
yeah.
Anyway, so Liam and Caleb kind of have a confrontation, and he injects Caleb with the genre drug. Right. So we got to talk about this, right? Because.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so then Caleb kind of experiences the rest of the episode as kind of these hyper-stylized film genres.
But are they hyper-stylized? Or did they just change the music and, like, fuzz the colors slightly?
It really was pretty rough, John Robinson. It felt like a iMovie filter, you know, that you could put on and you then dig out some music from, you know, greatest classical hits. Ride of the Valkyries and such. It didn't.
Well, okay, no, yeah. they put a little bit more into it. I played some musical detective, and here's what we've got. I don't know. So we start with the noir, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't know because the it goes black and white. We hear the like flicker of the film reel sort of thing, and then we get the like noir trumpets on the soundtrack. I couldn't figure out if there was like anything. To me, it sounded like a Westworld motif played via noir trumpets. But if I missed what I'm sure it has to be a film theme because all the rest are. So I'm sure I missed this one, and I just couldn't figure out what it was. Maybe by Sunday I will have cracked it. But the next one that happens is Ride of the Valkyries. That, of course, is used very famously in the helicopter bombing scene in Apocalypse Now. So we are in a sort of like war action sequence moment. Then after that, the things get all fuzzy and sweet, and we hear the theme song to the 1970s film Love Story plays on the soundtrack. So this is the Ally McGraw movie, very famous if you know anything about 70s film. It is was a hugely, hugely popular, very sappy love melodrama as Caleb is making eyes at Dolores. And then as they're going down into the train, we hear Nightclub In by Iggy Pop. That's off the Train Spotting soundtrack. So I don't really know what we're going for there. I guess like because they're going on a train and he's on drugs, question mark. I don't quite know the Train Spotting connection there, but that's where we are with that. He's kind of like he's kind of paranoid. He's looking all around him sort of thing. And then the last musical cue comes right before they're on the beach. And it's the theme from The Shining plays and on the soundtrack. And so you are in, I don't know, I have some further thoughts on that. But like basically you're in a horror film there. So that's fun, right? Like that's fun. And Space Oddity plays Ramin Djawadi cover, beautiful cover of Space Oddity plays David Bowie's song as they get off of the train. But that is not one of the genres because that's when like Caleb goes, whoa, what genre is this? And Giggles goes, reality, man. So that's not one of the five genres. That's like a misdirect. But anyway, so that's fun. But why didn't they like go with some like extreme visuals
right
to accompany this concept, you know?
Yeah. It just, I understand what they're going for, but yeah, the visuals are just, it felt like they got, you know, they used pretty simplistic methods to communicate it. And I have to think that this was different in concept than it was in execution. You know, that like there was some version of this where
like a bigger budget version of it,
a bigger budget version, or maybe one that was less grounded in reality, you know, because this felt like a kind of slightly stylized version of what the actual regular style of the show was, or the regular reality of the show was, you know?
Completely. And I was, you know, I was thinking how fun it could have been if they had like when you're in Kayla's perspective, maybe the costumes change, you know what I mean? Like maybe we're like, we see Dolores like glammed up as a femme fatale, right, in a noir, yeah, setting, or like they're in like 90s Scottish heroin chic in, you know, in the train spotting sequence, or you know, Apocalypse Now or soldiers, something like that, you know? And like, if we're switching back and forth between Kayla's perspective and what everyone else is seeing, like that would be a, like a fun visual way to pop in and out. I'm reminded of two things when I watched. Did you watch any of Legion?
Yeah, Noah Hawley's? I watched season one.
Yeah, so in season one, there's a great prolonged sequence where they like they flit in and out of like a silent film. You get title cards and everything, sort of like sequence. And you know, Legion, for whatever flaws it may have, is like stylish to the like max and really bold and ambitious visually. And so like that's an example of this exact thing done super well on Legion season one, or more recently the nostalgia trip episode of Watchmen that happened last season, where like you've got someone sort of tripping through time and bouncing between black and white and color in a way that is really, really, really compelling. And so then this just feels like 10%, you know, yeah, of effort put into this. So
I will say that the one component of it, did you ever see the movie Dredd? The
like the Judge Dredd
the
remake
Judge Dredd
thing?
With yeah. What's his yeah. name? The Carl Urban, right? That one.
Yeah.
First of all, great film.
Yep. Nina Heady,
and
great
the
stuff.
Thing that this reminded me most of is like slow-mo. There's a drug in that movie called slow-mo. When you take it, everything slows down. Yeah. And that's kind of that's the overarching effect I got, is because most of those genre effects involve slow motion to some capacity. And so I felt like it changed his perception of reality, and that the true function of it was to give him the flashbacks that we get at the end of the episode.
Exactly. Like,
that's why.
1,000%.
Right. Yeah. So. Yes. Okay. So anyway, there is that you reference this cool car chase sequence. It is pretty cool to see like these self-driving cars and him using a grenade launcher and the tracking the car. He fires it and it tracks the car and blows it up, and all that stuff is pretty cool, I think. But ultimately, it's so that they can get Liam's personal key code to get into the system, and then they get on a train and Dolores unleashes Rehoboam to everyone's devices. So after that, apparently, it causes the entire social order to break down. And I'm curious.
I mean, what if you got, this I think is interesting.
Yes.
This like rat speech and like this idea of like hope. Like, what if you got a message to your phone that was like, all right, you, Joanna, are like definitely going to. I don't know. It's all depressing. I don't want to do like a me. But like, you know, you, Sam, are going to like die.
Are you talking to Sam in the audience right now, or just a fictional Sam?
Oh, no. Our listener, Sam, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
okay, that, Sam.
Yeah, Sam. You're going to die. No. Anyway. So then like that gives you, then you don't have hope, which is what we need in order to like, move through in an orderly manner through society, right? This belief that our lives are going to turn out well. That's certainly what capitalism is funded on. Like this idea that like we're going to be successful, or at least our kids are going to be successful or something like that. And if you get, you know, a system, a highly accurate system telling you that's not going to be the case, or your child is going to die, God forbid, which is like what someone in this sequence learns or something like that. Or in the case of Lena Waithe's character, Ash, like her little brother is going to like turn out to be an awful monster, like all this sort of stuff. Yeah, society. I believe society would break down if that were the case, you know?
I don't necessarily disagree with you. I wasn't a huge fan of the execution in the show, just because I just think we've seen too little of – if you're telling me that, hey, in the future, everyone feels extremely repressed, right? Everyone's extremely repressed. Everyone has their own loops. They've been told by this machine what they're supposed to do, and they do that same thing every single day, and they have no hope for a better future. And then all of a sudden, what's on the machine gets told to them explicitly, and then they freak out because they've been living as basically slaves to these algorithms for the past, you know, X number of years, and now they're finally free. Would that cause them to revolt in some way? David Chen would say, yeah, I buy that. That makes sense. But I think we see so little of that world. You know, we see Caleb, and he's pretty repressed, and so we get that. But he's already rebelling. He's in the process of rebelling when we meet him, right? And then the only other humans we really see are the people who are ultra rich, right? Like Liam Dempsey Jr.'s world, and they basically don't need to obey the rules. And even if they did, they'd be pretty happy with their place in society. So I guess I just feel like there's been too little of society and like what life beyond the characters on screen is like for me to really believe that, hey, this would cause you to start freaking out because you got a weird text. So that's
I guess. And like, you know, to unfavorably compare it to something else. Did you see the BBC HBO co-pro Years and Years?
I saw the first episode. Never got into it. I've heard it's great though.
People feel mixed about it, but what it does show is a very convincing slow dissolution of our society, erosion of liberties, the collapse of various systems and institutions that we have in place. Like what would cause the complete collapse of society? And we see it unfold over the titular Years and Years. And so to watch it happen, I think you're right, to watch it happen in like 30 minutes.
Well, let me put it to you a different way, Joanna Robinson, which is that we have arguably in the last month seen things that are much more likely to provoke civil unrest than, you know, what we see in the show. You know, like just unemployment at levels that are barely comprehensible.
Yeah.
You know, pandemic that requires lockdowns in order to keep from overloading the health system. All these things I could list that we don't want to be reminded of because you're listening to this podcast to forget about those things. And I would say certainly there is social unrest to some degree, but people aren't freaking out in the streets and beating people. You know, it just doesn't. So anyway, I just didn't really. It felt comical to me. Yes, yet, you know, and but that's what I'm, that's my point, is that like it's very possible that is in our future, but it took like XYZ for that to happen that feels more extreme than what's depicted in the show. So maybe I have my cynical reality eye that's, you know, kind of looking at the show. But to me, all the scenes of people freaking out felt pretty comical rather than, oh my gosh, they finally see the Matrix, you know, it just didn't. It didn't work for me, unfortunately. I like the idea. As I explained, I like the idea. I just don't think the execution really lived up to it. So anyway.
I will say, like, this idea of maybe execution, but the what comes before it, this debate over, like, what will happen? Are you helping people or are you harming them to show them this information? Like, do we have an obligation as keepers of this information to shelter them from it, to protect them from it? And that's the question, right? Like, freedom versus chaos seems to be like the binary here. Mm. I just thought that was interesting. And I thought, like, maybe some of the, like, the, you know, cars on fire in the street stuff was like maybe a little comical, but I thought that like some of the devastation of the people on the train felt like touching to me. I feel mixed about it, I guess is the point.
Like the idea, didn't like the execution. And there's some things in this episode that I really like the execution of, you know, like I was talking about the flashbacks earlier. I thought that was really effective way of conveying the downfall of humanity and stuff like that. So I don't want to be a complete downer, but, I thought as with a lot of Westworld in its later seasons, 2 and 3, the ideas are stronger than the execution, in my opinion. Anyway, go ahead.
So they come out of the train and a couple of Starrock's people roll up and Dolores steps in front of Caleb because he's still like tripping, I guess, and takes 2 bullets for him. And so he's still on drugs, so maybe isn't fully processing what's happening. But, you know,
they definitely do dwell on the moment in the show.
They do. And he asks about it later. And she's like, we'll talk about it later. But like, you know, that's not something that it would happen to a human. So Caleb is maybe not fully like processed it, but is on the path to getting there.
Well, it does seem to answer your question from last week of whether he, or a couple weeks ago, whether he is aware that Dolores is a robot. It seems like he is not aware at this point.
Well, he's working on it, is the thing. So they wind up on this beach scene, right? And for some background, like, I just loved the shot of the businessman standing in the water, like, just in the background of everything. You know, like, he looked very much like, what's that Michael Douglas movie, Falling Down, right? He just looked very much like that. Like, he's just dropped his briefcase and, like, is standing in the water in his suit, just sort of, like, processing the information he got. Anyway,
that's basically what I look like every day at 5 p.m. by the way.
Fair enough. So we get this confrontation that Dolores largely stays out of between Ash and Giggles and Liam and Caleb. And Liam is ranting about, like, like, think of what we could have done without people like you. So he has something against, like, all three of the people who are not Dolores, right? Mm-hmm. But he has a special sort of, like, fear and anger around Caleb. Because whatever he sees in his glasses when he puts them on, when he looks at Caleb, terrifies him. In a way that doesn't when he looks at Ash and Giggles. Like, we get Ash's profile. We know what's going on with her. But we never get a look at Caleb's profile. We've seen it before because Dolores had a version of it. But I think we're all starting to agree that that is not the full story of Caleb. We brought up the Bourne identity before. And this is sort of like where I'm standing with this. This is my interpretation of this. When Liam first looks at Caleb early in the episode through the glasses, he says, "You think I killed your friend?" The way that line is read, it implies to me that Caleb is the one who killed Francis. And my interpretation is that a lot of Caleb's memories are actually implanted memories. They're not something that really happened to him, that the war is not true. Probably the strawberry milkshake story, which felt like very, like, weird and off at the time, is not true. And that he at some point was or is one of these undesirables, these uncontrollable chaotic elements in the system that Serac tried to edit and re-release to society. But even more so that he did some sort of, like, maybe like some wax work for Serac. We see him, like, he has a mysterious man played by a great Canadian actor Enrico Colantoni in brief flashback with, like, a hood over his head, and he's like got a gun on him and stuff like that. And Francis seems to be, like, working with him at that point. But then, like, did he later shoot Francis? ? At any rate, that seems to be the revelation here, right?
Well, he says something, I don't remember the exact quote, but he says something like, "You're the worst of them." Like, you don't even.
Yes. You don't even know who you are.
You don't even know who you are, right? So.
Yeah. So he's somehow something other than whatever Ash and Giggles are, right?
Yeah.
And so he's someone who, and, like, that helps us understand why his mother keeps going, like, "You're not my son." There was this theory that maybe Caleb was a host, but now it seems more apparent to me that, like, he's been, you know, reprogrammed somehow, like Jason Bourne, sort of thing.
Yeah. Humans can be reprogrammed as well, it seems.
Right. So,
you know, that reminds me, though, there was a scene in last week's episode when Dolores says to Caleb, "You know, I thought your world would be so much different than mine." Isn't that a weird thing to say if he thinks that she's human? You know what I mean? Anyway, just a random thought.
Yes. The question here, the big question for me here, and I feel like I already know my answer, but is, what does Dolores know, and when did she know it? So to me, by her reaction, because, like, you know,
she's not surprised.
No, Liam tells Caleb, like, "You did it."
Yeah.
He dies in Caleb's arm, right? And then Caleb asks Dolores, who does he think I am? And she is completely unperturbed, right?
They're saying,
you did it.
What?
You did it.
Who does he think I am? Who does he think I am? Hey. 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 Who do you think I am?
So, like, seems to me like she already knew what he was. And that makes sense as to why she's so interested in him, right? Don't you think? More so than, like, if he were just some, like, rando guy.
She's looking for another Teddy, basically.
Well, a Teddy, but, like, you know, isn't it interesting that this guy has been tinkered with? Like, that's not, mm-hmm. that's another, like... thing for her to probe into, but did she know about it when she showed him that tablet with like his edited profile on it? I think so, definitely. Did she know about it even at the very beginning, and her stumbling into his arms was planned from the start? I think that's possible too, knowing Dolores. So it just seemed a very convenient sort of like meet cute thing. I don't know. So yeah. either she knew then, she at least knew when she went to rescue him from the construction site. You know, what was going on there. So so Caleb, he is not what he appears to be.
Indeed. And as Enrico, many things in the show. Yeah.
Yeah, and Enrico Colantoni, who most people know from Veronica Mars, but was also on Just Shoot Me and also was on Nolan's other show, Persons of Interest, which is a show about...
Also Party Down, Joanna Robinson? Excuse me?
Obviously. he's not just going to be like a nobody in a flashback. So we're obviously going to get... I feel like we're obviously going to get more of that story.
It would be weird because he's like... he's a recognizable character actor, I think.
Yeah.
So it'd be weird to just have him be in this one flashback scene. So
Enrico... A person of interest, I went off on a length about this on the other Westworld podcast I do, but like people have for years, Westworld fans, Nolan fans have been trying to get me to watch Person of Interest. And I'm like, life's too short, bro. But as it turns out, you know, do you know the premise of Person of Interest, the CBS series that Jonathan Nolan did before this one?
I do not.
Okay, so character actor Michael Emerson of Lost fame plays a, you know, a billionaire genius creator guy who has made a system that is able to predict terrorist attacks. And the U.S. government uses it to like cut off terrorist attacks before they happen. But the system is also able to predict like lower level crimes, but the government feels like that's, you know, not worth their time. They don't want to get involved. So he enlists Jim Caviezel to basically go stop these, you know, it's a very Minority Report, like stop these crimes before they happen sort of thing. But as the seasons go on, it becomes this meditation on like, AI and control and, you know, a system controlling our lives and like that. Like it is very much the same story that we are dealing with here in season three. So maybe we should all go watch Person of Interest. I don't know. But
that's really the takeaway from this episode of the podcast. Check out Person of Interest.
Should we hit this last scene in the airplane hangar?
Oh, yeah. So what I'll say about these scenes in the airplane hangar with the Vincent Cassell hologram is I was impressed that they were able to maintain Vincent Cassell's lighting on the plane in his hologram. You know, I was like, huh, what a nice little detail there. Because he's like sitting in his plane and there's like the sun shining on his face. And that's also true of his hologram. Anyway, so Caleb gets a package from presumably another one of those guys in the app.
The Rico
app. He's like, hey, man, I just deliver it. You know, this is, I don't do personals.
Maybe Liam was right. Maybe people shouldn't know their own fate.
People have the right to know. You wanted to know, right?
Well, maybe I'm not like other people.
And then They get on the plane to do what exactly, do you think?
I think. Here's my theory. If Caleb is, and I should say I've not seen the like next time on Westworld, so this is pure, I think. If Caleb is a Treadstone agent, if he is someone who has been, because one of the things he sees in his flashback is himself strapped down to like a white chair. He's got some goggles on and there's like a woman standing over him and looks like a doctor of some kind, perhaps running an experiment on him or something like that. So let's say that Caleb was re-educated in that like warehouse in the middle of, the desert that Liam Dempsey Sr. visited. Then I would guess that Dolores would be taking him there to maybe trigger some memories and find out what's happening there right now. I imagine they're going to go there in true Westworld style because we know they at least have at least one other facility, the Inner Journeys facility, which does not look anything like the warehouse where Liam Dempsey Sr. went. Mm-hmm. So like, maybe they've upgraded their locations and are masquerading as a mental facility or whatever. But so my guess, classic Westworld style, would be for them to go to that facility and it would be like abandoned and like, this is, hopefully they did Serac did a good job cleaning up after himself, but you never know.
you can never rely on that guy to be super clean about his stuff. I'm gonna say they're getting on a plane to intercept Serac. I'm gonna put that out there. Okay. See what's going on with there.
Maybe they're going to Berlin.
I haven't thought nearly as hard about it as you, so I think you're probably right. But I'm just going to put that out there.
The other thing I want to say about all that. Do I have anything else to say about all that? We haven't heard from Maeve this week, but presumably she's being rebuilt somewhere. We haven't heard from Charlotte this week. My take on the, white wall facility, where they walk by all these people in their glass cells, that looked very like intentionally, the Mesa, where, you walk by, people are being sort of experimented on, in
it
the
reminded
park.
Me of, the Forge, right? Or what's the one with the library and you see all the little rooms?
Oh yeah. The Forge.
Is it the Forge? Anyway, it's one
of those. Yeah, that's the Forge, not the Cradle. Yeah. With the library. Yeah, that's a good point. And also, in season one, there were like, when the robots would be like glitching, like there was a flashback to the early park, and you saw like Armistice, and she had sort of like clawed at her own arm. And you saw, I think you saw Abernathy, like basically these hosts that were having, they look sort of deranged, but what's true is that, there's just like glitches in their programming or whatever. Mm. So I don't know. Anyway.
Cool parallels.
Yeah. It's almost as if our world and their world are not so different.
It's true. We're alike, you and I. Okay. Mm. I think that's going to wrap us up for this week's episode. Love the flashback stuff. Wasn't a fan of the other stuff. Always great to see Vincent Cassell do some nice work on screen. But overall, I thought it was a pretty rough episode. Sounds like you actually liked it quite a bit.
If you take the genre stuff out, if you take a lot of the Caleb and Dolores stuff out, like I like all the Serac stuff.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah, I agree. The Serac stuff is pretty strong so far.
And I do want to give a shout out to you got to create for the production design of like what the Insight system looks like.
Yeah.
Not just the big globe, but like all the screens that Connells is interfacing with. They look incredible. I thought they looked really cool.
And I know I've talked about this ad infinitum, but I do think like Devs is just a really interesting parallel. These are two shows taking on somewhat similar topics and so in extremely different ways. Right, they could not be more different stylistically, and that's just fascinating to see. Like these two shows on the air, like at the same time, and talking about really similar topics, but doing it in really different ways. It's like a kind of interesting creative experiment, almost. You gave two directors the same creative brief, and they ran with it in different, wildly different directions. So it's just really interesting to see. So Devs is on Hulu right now and on FX. Would recommend it. Okay, that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. Thanks to Beatty Zhang for editing this episode. Thanks to Simplecast for powering Decoding Westworld. Simplecast is the first and last word in podcast management and analytics. Learn more at simplecast.com. And you can find more episodes of this podcast at decodingwestworld.com. Email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Until next week, Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
Oh, they can find me on vanityfair.com. I will be covering... I'm really excited to be doing this. I'm covering the show Mrs. America for the Still Watching podcast. This is an FX on Hulu joint. And we've gotten FX has like sort of rolled out the carpet in terms of access to interviews for the podcast. So we have great guests like Kate Blanchett, Uzo Aduba, Rose Byrne. Like, this cast is incredible. And we're getting to talk to all of them for the podcast. So Still Watching... Mrs. America for Vanity Fair. Check it out. I love the show. I think the show is incredible. Davi Waller, who was a longtime writer and producer on Mad Men, is the creator of this. And it's really got that sort of like lived in. She also worked on Halt and Catch Fire. It's got that like lived in recent history vibe to it. And it's a really, really great story, great cast. So check out the show and check out the podcast.
Awesome. Yeah, I've heard. The show is great. I look forward to watching it. And congrats on the big gets on the podcast. But yeah, the show is Mrs. America, and it's going to be on FX on Hulu. I'm looking forward to watching it. So
starting April 15th.
Yeah. And find me on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. I also host a show called Culturally Relevant. Check that out. It's interviews with filmmakers, artists, and writers. Until next week, we'll see you later.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.